Welcome to One on One, a new Squawker podcast starring our very own Rory Briggs. How are you doing, Rory?
I'm doing great. I'm very, very excited to present my new podcast for you and for
the
listeners.
I'm very excited to listen to it. It's a bit different to our usual ones. I mean, football's not just about the numbers, and I think you'll be getting some interesting stories and some interesting discussions out of people within the game and outside the game. But who, have you got any clues for who the first guest on Squawker One on One?
Well, my first clue is he has been described as the Indiana Jones of soccer writing.
Wow. Does he carry a whip?
He has a hat, so let's see. But the second clue is he actually lives in Belgrade.
Oh, wow.
Serbia.
So a little bit different to Indiana Jones, who's clearly US-based
but
adventurer.
He is a traveller, and he's visited some of the fiercest, most obscure derbies in world football.
Wow. Who could this man be? This man of mystery?
It's only James Montagu.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I can't wait to listen. Shall we get straight to it?
Let's have a go. I'm joined today by award-winning author and journalist James Montagu. His works include When Friday Comes, Football in the War Zone, 31-0, On the Road with Football's Outsiders, which won the 2015 TalkSport Football Book of the Year at the Sports Book of the Year Awards.
It did.
How was that for you? Was that a surprise?
It was a huge surprise, because 31-0 is a book about underdogs and international underdogs. Mm. And so there's a chapter in there about San Marino. 31-0 is about, I mean, it's named after the American Samoa team that lost 31-0. And every time you write about those teams, there's always a huge discussion about whether these minnows should play. I mean, we just had it with Thomas Muller and San Marino saying that they should qualify before they play. I think they won 8-1 in the end. So bearing in mind it's Talk Sport, and I went on Talk Sport before the awards, and I think it was Hawksby and Jacobs, and we ended up having a kind of quite well-natured, but a proper argument
about debate
it. You know,
about
they were
it,
like, they shouldn't be there. And I'm like, no, this is the spirit of international football. And when I saw I was nominated, I saw it was the TalkSport Award, and they were handing out the awards. So I thought there was no chance. But I mean, I went along because it was a free dinner and a free bar. I don't think they quite believed it either, that I was nominated. And it was a huge shock, but it was lovely, lovely surprise. So I still got a free bar and a free dinner. But
that's all about. Well, we're going to be hearing a bit from 31-0 coming up in the show. Going to be providing a little extract from us.
I will do,
for us. And you've also got a forthcoming book, which you're still yet to complete, though. It still is in the works.
Well, finished it.
You finished it.
But it has to go. It's going to some lawyers at the moment.
I see,
and it's being, there's the final edits being put in place. I think it'll be out. It's called The Billionaires Club. And it's about the super rich, who they are, why they're buying our football clubs. Yeah. And more importantly, where did their money come from? Because a lot of these characters who come in, you think we know very little about, because they're billionaires, they're very secretive about stuff. Mm. Football's an incredible lens and opens up a little bit of space to explore who they are. And if you think of who owns Manchester City, I mean, it's the royal family of Abu Dhabi, part of the United Arab Emirates, seven royal families that make that up. The oligarchs in the former Soviet Union, all this money that's come from China, you know, is trying to make a connection between it all.
Sure, yeah.
And trying to work out why and when and how and what lies in the future. Yeah. You know.
And you've also, as announced Wednesday, you're now a finalist for the Foreign Press Association's Economic Story of the Year.
Yeah,
for a billion reasons to believe.
Yeah, that was a strange one, because I mean there's a Foreign Press Association. I mean, David Goldblatt won the Small Story of the Year last year, and I thought, I'll put a sports story
great
in, because David's
a great,
I mean, he's a bit of a hero of mine. Anyone who's read The Ball Is Round will probably recognise all of my work in that. But I had two stories I wanted to put in. One was about, I wrote for the New York Times about the Qatar workers having their own cup competition in Doha. And another one was this Bleacher Report story I did, which was a fantastic experience. Go to China and find out a bit about football there and the business of football there. So, I last minute I just put it in, and next thing I know I'm up against the New Yorker. I mean, I think this one really is a kind of chaotic bid for that prize. I think I'm just you know, I've got to wear a tux, I'm going to go along and
enjoy the night
and really hammer the bar for that one, because I'm not sure if I'll ever get nominated for a business award again.
Thank you very much for joining me for an episode of One on One, where we discuss your work and also, more importantly, your life as a fan and the things you love about the game. So starting off, when did you first fall in love with football? What were your memories of?
I've written about this before, about the first kind of real memory. I remember my dad trying to force West Ham on me, and actually not being that, I mean, quite cold by it. I mean, this is like four or five. I mean, I remember seeing it and being bored by it. But the first time it really excited me was the first thing I can remember. I was about 7 years old, and it was 1986. And it was the quarterfinal, England-Argentina. And I remember to this day, we were on holiday in Clovelly, somewhere in the West Country. And we'd come back just in time for the game. And me and my dad were sitting there and we watched it. And I remember watching it, the handball. I was old enough to know that this was something that was wrong. I couldn't believe that the universe would allow that to happen. But he's cheated, Dad. I remember my dad being apoplectic, going apoplectic. And then me, I was just crying and crying and crying, because I think it was more important. I fell in love with football there, and you learn a lot of lessons about that. But it was really like learning about the unfairness of the world, that sometimes, even when you're right, things don't go your way. Yeah. So that's the first thing I always remembered. And then from then onwards, I've come from a family of West Ham fans. I would go to Upton Park, what, bowling ground. I'd stand in the North Bank. It was cheap. This was just before the Premier League era, just at the start of it, really. So I was lucky. I can remember standing. I remember the feel of, being kind of crushed in, obviously kind of post Hillsborough. That's something that most people don't have a recollection of. I remember it being dangerous. I also remember it being kind of exhilarating in a way, as a young boy, I kind of fell in love with football because of that proximity and that collective experience that you have, and the danger of it. You're small, you can't really see anything. I've got a 1-year-old daughter, would I let my 10, 11-year-old loose in the equivalent of the North Bank? There's no way I'd do it today. I don't know whether that means because we're a bit more, careful about stuff. But it was, and so from then on, that was it. I was a dyed-in-the-wool West Ham fan and would go overland and sea for the rest of my life until I moved away.
So what now inspires you about football now to write that sort of thing?
Well, the same thing that inspired me in the first place, really. One of them that's kind of a common theme in all my work, I think, is the underdog. Having played football myself, being terrible, losing constantly. Yeah. I have an affinity to the losers when it comes to football, especially the goalkeepers, because I'm a terrible losing goalkeeper. And so I've always been really interested in how people set themselves up, even in the most extreme circumstances, with no hope whatsoever. But there's that sliver of something, that belief that maybe this time will be our time. And I think part of it is supporting a team. There are much smaller teams that have all sorts of problems, than West Ham United. But we were a yo-yo club. We always seem to be losing. We always seem to be on the verge of chaos. Mm. FA Cup, third round, first round. These were kind of formative experiences. And the way that the British, I think, talk about underdogs, it's really part of, central part of our character. Mm. We need to know that there's a potential for, David to kind of break the crown of Goliath. We still need that, and we still see that narrative all the time in writing and television and film. So it's still that, and I rarely write about British football, English football in particular. I rarely write about the Premier League. I don't really go to many Premier League games. I don't really live in the, I haven't lived in the country full time for about 10 years now.
You're based in Belgrade,
but based in Serbia at the moment. But I've been in Romania and the Middle East for a long time, and I've been very lucky. I've just sought out those stories, that maybe people don't see our stories, but are kind of at the margins, says something about the human condition, and maybe something wider about the world as well. I started out as a political journalist and studied politics, so I kind of often see the political ramifications of sport or how the politics of society is reflected in sport, and especially football. Anyone that's read Simon Cooper's work, he's hit another inspiration for me, Football Against the Enemy. And so I still get it's the same joy going to... I remember when I was in, I went to watch Bhutan play Sri Lanka in their first ever World Cup match. Managed to get to Sri Lanka, managed to get to Bhutan.
What was the pitch like?
Well, in Sri Lanka wasn't too bad, actually. In Bhutan, they had the most incredible stadium in Thimphu.
I'm imagining a hillside somewhere.
It's a mountain. It's the second highest. Drop. Yeah, I mean, it's the second highest. I mean, if you've ever played Tomb Raider on the PlayStation, it's kind of like that. All these temples with these prayer wheels. It's the second highest capital city in the world. The air's thin. Mm. The architecture is just this beautiful kind of Himalayan wooden kind of crazy Bhutanese thing going on. Lots of carved penises on the walls as well, because they have this, they revere the ejaculating penis. It's a kind of symbol of, not quite virility, but it's kind of like you see it everywhere. And it's
but they don't have that on the football shirt.
They don't have that on the football shirt, but they are missing a trick with that. But you can buy carved wooden penis key rings outside, outside the ground, so you can always hit those later. But it was the most magnificent stadium I've ever been to, and it was their first World Cup home match, and there was 35,000 people, half day by the government, so everybody was off work, 35,000 people dressed in Bhutanese kind of clobber, winning their first ever game. And I remember before that game, I spoke to Sri Lanka's Serbian coach, I said, you know, it's a few hours before kickoff. I still get that when I prepare to go to a game, that excitement, and you know, I'm packing my stuff, you know, my kit, like my BBC mic and a few other bits and pieces, and I'm going and I'm so excited. I mean, you must have that. And he was like, I'm jealous that you have that. He didn't have that anymore. For him, it was a job, it was a process. For me, it's still kind of the best job in the world. It's kind of a hobby.
Yeah,
and I'm just astounded that people can actually pay me and I can live.
That's the joy of it.
Kind of get by with it, you know.
So your new book, The Billionaires Club, you know, pursuing people who were at the top of the game, the hierarchy of the global game, but specifically the owners. What was the inspiration there? You've kind of gone from the outsiders to the insiders, I suppose.
It's the ultimate insiders. These are the super rich. These are the masters of the universe. These are the people that don't just control football, but control the world. And for me, I had this idea, first of all, 2008, when I did a book about football in the Middle East, When Friday Comes. And I was living in the United Arab Emirates in Dubai for almost 3 years. And I could see the rank hypocrisy within the country, within the people that lived there, whether they were expats or locals, because at the center of that society was a system of slavery, which we've now learned from writing about Qatar and the World Cup, the kafala system, which is a system of sponsorship that traps men, mainly from Southeast Asia, in these horrific conditions. I couldn't get a single editor in the UK to care about this in Dubai. I mean, I managed to write something for The Big Issue and a few other investigations at the time.
No one would touch it?
Nobody would touch it. Yeah. It was kind of like, well, yeah, but I mean, the story we want to tell about Dubai is this glittering place that's sprung out of the desert, and it kind of ran counter to that. And I was like saying, I've gone to places, I've seen thousands of trafficked women in nightclubs. You know, this place, once you scratch the surface, it's morally a very disturbing and troubling place. And you saw how the royal families acquiesced in that, you know, and in terms of democracy, there's no democracy, there's no people started getting arrested for tweets. I mean, there's a real, you know, really one of the most awful in the region. And this isn't the region that's well known for its human rights, kind of adherence to human rights. I mean, this is one of the most egregious abuses of human rights in the region. And then they bought Manchester City, or the Sheikh Mansour, the president of the club, also a member of the Abu Dhabi royal family, who was integral to the government. He was in the cabinet. He was basically considered the right hand man of the president, who's the head of the Abu Dhabi royal family. And I couldn't see how people, after all the issues that Man City had with Thaksin Shinawatra about the human rights and about fit and proper persons and all this, that this guy was getting a complete, you know, free card.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was talking about, well, where is this money coming from? Why do people not think about that, whether that's important for their clubs?
So you're worried about the regulation then, I suppose.
What I'm worried about, fundamentally what it's about, is how much should football fans care about who owns their club and where the money comes from? And but when you talk to most fans, it's when they're winning, it's not an issue. But when things go wrong, suddenly it is. Mm. You talk to Chelsea fans. I mean, Abramovich is incredibly popular there for everything he's done for the club. But if you look at the past 10 years of what Abramovich has been up to, when you look at the court case with Boris Berezkovsky, the largest civil litigation case in the history of the British courts, you know, this guy's a right-hand man to Putin and does his bidding. And, you know, this is a country, Russia, that is, you know, civil society has been destroyed virtually. And he's played his part in that. And I guess what I wanted to do was try to raise the, you know, raise the flag and say, this isn't, you know, we complain when we see kind of nefarious behaviour in smaller clubs, owners come in, asset strip. But what about these other guys who have managed to hide all this? And but they're hiding in plain sight. It's all out there if you want to go to it. So I decided to, I'm never going to get any interviews with these guys. I'm never going to find out anything from their inner circle. They've got that locked down. So what I wanted to find out is speak to the people who have lost, the losers from their power and their money. So when it came to the UAE, I went to villages in Bangladesh to visit the workers who have been trafficked to the UAE, others who had been arrested and tortured and sent home for going on strike about their poor paying conditions, and try and paint a picture of what's going on there and how these characters that we see regularly talking about football are complicit in it. So it was in there, it was Qatar, Russia, Ukraine, China. China was a big one. I spent a lot of time in China looking at the kind of connections. But in each case, it was how did it... With China, I went to Ardo Den Haag, who had been bought out by a Chinese owner, and how that's been affected by the money, and then try to see how normal people like me and you are, you know, have had their lives ruined by the investment, and often cloaked in the extremely kind of positive message, but in the end they pay for it in the end. And and I think it's a warning as well about where the game's headed, and where not just the game, I think the world, in terms of the power that the super rich can wield.
In terms what? In terms of sort of a global proxy, using the Premier League as a proxy.
Yeah, I mean these. I mean this isn't at the end. I think what you discover is that there isn't any. At first, there's geographical differences. I look at the Chinese. I split the world into kind of four areas: America, Eastern Europe, Asia, but primarily looking at China and the Middle East. And by the end, you realise that it's kind of the same money and the same investments, people in the same cities doing the same things. This is a separate class of people who are controlling not just football, but banking and media and all sorts of areas. And there's so little transparency about what they're doing. Yet when you look at in their home countries, how they've risen and how they've used their power when they're there, I think it's telling that what you learn there, I think, is a warning to the future of not just the game, but also for the future of, I mean, I don't want to say it's grand to say the future of democracy, humanity. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I can't see it getting any better. I can't see their wings being clipped anytime soon, especially given what's happening with the elections in America and other places. So it's... So yeah, it was quite an emotional journey because you go into refugee camp, you go to I managed to sneak into some of the worker camps in Qatar, speaking to people. I mean, people whose lives have been absolutely ruined by this system. It was draining. Yeah. You saw a lot of kind of unhappiness. So it's not a happy-go-lucky book.
No. But it's out in May.
It's out in May, hopefully, if the lawyers say it's okay.
Good, let's hope for that. And you're going back to your first book, I'm right in thinking When Friday Comes.
Yeah.
Looking at The Outsider and, you know, looking at some... spending a lot of time in these countries and going to the games, the big derbies, the fierce rivalries. What's the best game you've ever seen live?
I mean, in the Middle East or everywhere?
Everywhere. I suppose with your experience of going across... so many different continents.
The one that I always think about there were two, actually. One was Egypt-Algeria World Cup qualifier in 2009. And I wrote about this in the book and for 442 as well. I mean, this was just one of those experiences you'll never forget. It was called... There was a lot of history between Egypt and Algeria. In 1990, or I think it was 89, the two played to reach the World Cup finals in Italy. But Egypt were kind of really small team, hadn't qualified. I think they'd had like a qualifying game in the 30s or whatever, but they had never, you know, really qualified for a major tournament like that. And Algeria had that great team of the kind of 1980s that should have gone further in 82. Mm. And it was called the Death Match. It was kind of riots at the game. Egypt won.
Funny because they're not neighbouring countries.
They're not neighbouring countries.
This is all football related.
This is all football related. So I mean, there is in the Maghreb, in the north, yeah. there is a rivalry. You go to see, you know, Morocco and Tunisia, you know, have a huge yeah. rivalry. I mean, all those countries have a big rivalry with each other. But there was the team doctor, Egyptian team doctor, lost his eye after being glassed on the pitch, and his name escapes me now. But the famous Lakhdar Barami, I think his name is, the famous Algerian midfielder from that era. He was blamed for it. So there was an Interpol arrest warrant, yeah. international arrest warrant. So he couldn't leave Algeria for years. And there's a lot of bad blood about this. And then it came down to this one game in Cairo, and it was kind of rehash of all this past history. The Cairo International Stadium, it had like, there's like 110,000 people there. And it was, I mean, it was quite frightening in the run up because you saw the full weight of Mubarak's state, police state, the press, everything, whipping the population into this kind of anti-Algerian fever, which came to a crescendo in this game. And the atmosphere, I remember having to get into the stadium because back then I would never go and sit in the press box. I'd always go and sit with the fans because you'd get a much better atmosphere and it was just better watching the games like that. And I was in behind the goal. You had to get there six hours before kickoff. I remember I'd been sick for a few days, so I wasn't in the best of health. And I just took loads of Imodium just in case I didn't shit myself.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there, and a couple of mates were there, and this game approached, and the atmosphere was like unlike anything I've ever seen. And they had to win by two clear goals for all the points to be equal in the group, and they would have to have another playoff. So it came down to this game, and they scored. I think they scored in the first couple of minutes. I think it might have even been Amir Zaki that scored. And then the game was terrible for the rest. It was one of the most abject games of football I've ever seen. I think it was the fifth minute of injury time, one of the final kicks of the game. They score, and it's 2-0, and it means that there's going to be a playoff. And just the explosion of joy and anger and relief. It was just, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking of it now. I mean, it was, you know, there were riots afterwards. I know the Algerian team bus was attacked, and there's all sorts of other incidents. But I mean, I'll never forget that. And then the other, watching Libya qualify for the African Cup of Nations during the war.
What year was it? 2011, yeah.
And this was still chaos back home. A lot of the players had been fighting on the front lines and had come back for the team to qualify, and they were playing the Zambia in northern Zambia, and I managed to get on the team flight from Tunisia. They let me go with them, so I managed to get into Zambia with them, and I was in the dressing room. They draw 0-0, and it was a really tense game, and they had to wait for other results to go their way, and I was sitting there in silence with the players, and they were just sitting there waiting, and it seemed to go on for an eternity, and the kit man came in and just like screaming. I think Nigeria had lost to Guinea or something. And it was everything. It was the war. It was this outpouring of just incredible emotion. They'd made it, and that was, I think those two matches, I can remember, ironically, both of them being pretty bad games. But in terms of everything that was around it, it was it was.
If you had to pick a favourite out of the two,
probably the Egypt game, just because it had the early goal, it had the late goal. Yeah. You know, it was in a way. They had earned that replay. They ended up obviously losing the replay in Sudan. But the other one, I think, was, I mean, it was a game where they were kind of watching what was going on elsewhere. So this was I think the one in Cairo was the favourite one.
Well, having read When Friday Comes, there's some pretty odd situations you get yourself into, some hairy situations, but some quite comical ones as well. What do you think is the strangest experience you've had covering football?
Well, the thing is, I mean, a lot of the stuff ends up not being about football at all. You know, you're going there nominally on a football story, and then it ends up being something completely different. I mean, covering Egypt, for instance, and the revolution and everything that involved the fans and the ultras of Al Ahly and the Port Said massacre, where 72 fans were killed. 72 fans were killed. there was about a year where there was no football in Egypt. So there was a year when I was in Egypt and there was just sitting around. I was going to protests. I was on the front lines in Tahrir Square. Mm. I was watching people burn down police vans in the middle of the square. I'd go to Alexandria with the ultras of Al Ahly and go to these marches and these rallies. You know, and there was a point where I was like, I mean, I can't remember the last time I've seen Egypt play. I mean, it was or Egypt or any of the club teams. So there are, I mean, the straight, I mean, one of, for When Friday Comes, one of the funniest, and one, it's kind of bittersweet. It's quite poignant now. I went to Yemen in 2007, I think it was. And I went there because there was a problem with khat, which is this leaf drug that people chew. Everybody chews cats, and it's like taking. Do you remember a few years ago? There's a drug. I think it's methadrone.
Mm.
They called it meow meow.
The legal high.
The legal high that then got made illegal. It's the same active ingredient in that. So when you chew it, it's like kind of smoking weed and taking ecstasy at the same time. So you kind of up and down, and it really messes with you.
Yeah.
So I went there because I'd found it in a newspaper a story about how all the players had been banned from taking part in an Olympic qualifier or kind of under 23 game where they took a drug test and all of them failed it because they'd been taking this this leaf which grows at a certain altitude within Yemen.
And they just chew it, don't they?
They just chew it and you chew it for hours and hours and hours and you kind of lose your teeth and you kind of, it's like chewing tobacco except it completely mashes you
up. There's a similar one in Myanmar and Burma where people the betel nut, they chew it and they get red teeth.
This is it. But imagine, I mean, there's nothing, there's, I mean, not even coca leaves are as strong as this. This is real, you know, it's really powerful. You can feel the waves of this stuff like affecting you. And you see, I was in Sana'a and everything stops at 1 o'clock and everybody goes to the market because when you pick the leaves, it's only got a few hours before it's completely useless. So it's you know, really, you know, active when as soon as you picked it. So they get down there, spend all their money on it and then they're out. They're just on the floor. You know, and you see doorways, people slumped everywhere, or they go back home, but they don't do anything. And I met this kind of, the head of the FA there, this Elliot Ness character, who had decided they're not going to chew cat anymore, we're going to have a modern football team and a modern FA and a modern league. And we spent the day together, lovely guy, Hamad. We went everywhere. He showed me everywhere around Saddab, met his friends, showed me the doctors, all the stuff they were doing. And then at the end of the day, he said, right, let's come back to mine. It was Friday. Go back to his. He has a majlis, which is this little kind of room within a house where you greet your guests. And he just pulled out some bags of like top quality cat. And it just showed me how deep it was because even the head of the FA couldn't.
Having said all this.
Having said all that, you know, was bang on it as well. So we ended up chewing it. And I mean, before I know it, 8 hours have gone and we've talked about how we're going to revolutionise Yemeni football. We're going to kind of have a Premier League style makeover and all this. And then you stop chewing and you have this crack, the come down and you crash. And then you just want to leave as quickly as possible. Most of them end up drinking whiskey to kind of like cure their shakes. You know, it was sad because you think now I went to a league game and it was a great match. I mean, there's good 10,000-15,000 people have turned up for this league game, and now it's a war zone, and the Saudis and the British government complicit in it, and the American government too, in the arms sales to the Saudis it's a forgotten brutal conflict. And I often think of my time in Sana'a and Hamad and all the players. And
what are they doing now? What's the situation with the football team?
Well, with the football team is when they had the World Cup qualification, they couldn't have any games there, and the airport was held by the rebels. So they had to take a merchant ship from Aden to Djibouti. So there's this picture one of the players put on Twitter of them on this, you know, like a cargo ship. Yeah. They're all on the cargo ship going to Djibouti, where from there they would then fly to, I can't remember who they were playing. It might have even been Myanmar. And they had to fly, and they lost every, they had played their home games in Qatar. But I think they lost almost every one of their games. They didn't make it. So the game is ruined. I think Hamad's still alive, but it's very difficult communication. So I can't, you know, I mean, but I'm next year, I'm going to make it my job to find out how they're all doing and try and go to a game. So I think they've got some Asian Cup qualifiers next year. So so I'm going to catch up with them. But that's a memory that I'll never forget.
Mm. Bizarre. So then the next book, you're, you know, looking again at the outsiders, but covering a bit more in a bit more across the globe. 31-0, named after the scoreline between American Samoa and Australia, yeah. Wasn't it in 2003 or 2001?
2001.
Which you've probably seen the film, the documentary film.
I was there.
Next Goal Wins.
I was there. That was Next Goal Wins. Was I turned up for this tournament, for this, which is written about in the book, because I thought I have to go. I have to go and do a story. I have to do a chapter about American Samoa if my book's going to be called 31-0. And I remember I had a tiny advance and I stretched it out. I mean, I think I had to go to Rwanda first, and then I managed to get myself via, I mean, it took me like six stops and I ended up in Samoa. And I thought, I've only got a day before this first match of this World Cup qualification campaign that they've got. But luckily, I crossed the international date line, so I didn't realise I'd actually gained a day. So this is great, I can prepare for it. And they had a tournament, Tonga, Cook Islands and Samoa, alongside American Samoa, the worst four teams.
Big rivals, though. Samoa versus American Samoa.
Exactly. It's one. Well, I mean, one's an American dependency. The other one's a kind of a sovereign state. But yeah, I mean, tribally, culturally, very similar. Mm. So I turn up and I just walk into the American Samoa camp, and there's Thomas Rongen, this big white-haired Dutch coach, who at first I think is American because he's got such an American accent, but he's been living in America for years. He used to play.
Funnily enough, about him, we did a list of the best football documentaries to watch before he died, and he actually responded because we included Next Goal Wins, and he was very happy, thanked us for his inclusion.
He's a
very nice guy.
He is an absolute. At first, I thought he was going to be like one of these kind of hotheads, like give the hairdryer, but I met him, and he was just this. It's this kind of chain smoking. I mean, he kicks ass. He needs to, but he's just got heart of gold.
Because it comes across when he's coaching. Yeah. When you watch him coach these players, he's, you know, no, there's nothing, you know, you can get past this guy.
No, you can't. I mean, you can't. I mean, he was, luckily I brought some, he'd run out of cigarettes at that point. He smokes filterless Camels. And he'd run out of filterless Camels. He didn't have any cigarettes. But I brought some roll-ups. So I've never seen anybody roll fatter roll-ups. It was like this thick. I mean, obviously this is a podcast, so you can't see my fingers, but maybe an inch and a half thick, yes, where he was just without a kind of filter. And he knocked these boys into shape. And I remember doing an interview straight. He let me in straight away, got great access. And then straight away, I don't want this to sound sexist, but I remember like this really beautiful woman walking past, and I remember I just remember seeing her in the corner of my eye.
Oh no, I think I know where this is going.
And he said, oh yeah, that's our centre back who's starting tomorrow or the next day, and it was Jaya, the transgender centre back they had. And so then this whole universe opened up. It wasn't just a story about this team that always lost. It wasn't even about the fact that Nicky Salapi, the goalkeeper, who was the goalkeeper that let in those 31 goals, was there as well, psychologically absolutely ruined by this experience. But there was also this transgender centre-back, a member of the Fafafina, which is this third sex that is recognised in Polynesian culture. And I met the boys who were there filming Next Goal Wins. If you watch Next Goal Wins, you can see me in the background because I was in various places kind of ruining their shots.
Just hiding in the corner.
I mean, they interviewed me for it, but they obviously that hit the cutting room floor quite quickly. So, but that was, I mean, that I would say in terms of another game that I will never forget is the first game that I went to there, and they played Tonga. And everybody was expecting, there was 20 people in the crowd, but the first ever victory and seeing them win that game and being there for this moment that nobody saw at the time, but obviously became kind of iconic moment in this film was beautiful. It was beautiful. Yeah. And to me, that showed me more. I mean, I knew how powerful football is and what it means to me, but seeing that, you know, I implore anybody who complains about underdogs or kind of, you know, football's about the elite and just about the elite, go and watch this documentary Next Goal Wins, and you'll see just what it means for these players when they beat Tonga, you know, which for most people would be considered something very simple to do, but for them it was the highlight of their lives, I think.
Well, now let's have a passage from 31-0 read to you by James.
Okay, I think
which what have you chosen for us?
I was looking through, I mean, I was going to going to suggest something on Palestine, but it's already on, when you go on Amazon, it's already kind of the free preview.
Fair enough, yeah.
So I'm going to read a few pages about Haiti, which was the second place I went to.
Okay. Which is of course not having a great time at the moment.
Of course, no. And really hasn't had a great time for the past 50 years. So, I went there, I travelled there for the first football match that they'd had after the earthquake. And you'll get an impression,
sure.
I think.
Let's hear.
Right. The sun is beating down on workers scrubbing the terraces of the Stade Silvio Cator in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince. In the distance, to the south of the stadium, verdant mountains rise sharply. Closer by sits the city's Grand Cimetière, famous for its warren of elaborate tombs. But the stadium is alive with movement and purpose. Men with pots of blue, red and yellow paint, the colours of the Haitian flag, coat and recoat the terraces. The burst of sunshine is unexpected, a break from the dark clouds that have been sitting above Haiti for the past few weeks. Hurricane season has begun, a time for prayer and a time to ask God for good luck. Most years, God ignores Haiti. It has long been the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere after years of being ruled by half-mad despots. First, François Papadoc Duvalier, a man who put close to 30,000 opponents of his regime to death. Then his son, Baby Doc, who looted and maimed until he finally was deposed in 1986. Their most evil legacy, though, was the Tonton Macoutes, a paramilitary force that raped, tortured and murdered with impunity. Anyone who could flee the country did so. Those too poor to get out stayed and waited, surviving from one hurricane season to the next. Yet it was the ground beneath their feet that was the source of Haiti's biggest betrayal. At 4:53 p.m. on the 12th of January 2010, an earthquake measuring 7.0 on the Richter scale reduced much of Port-au-Prince to rubble. By one count, more than 300,000 Haitians lost their lives, although no one can be sure just how many perished. It left Port-au-Prince already on the cusp of anarchy in a ruinous state. Every spare scrap of ground has now become a city of tents, filled with the internally displaced. Haiti's National Stadium, named after Silvio Cator, the country's greatest Olympian, a former footballer who won silver in the long jump at the 1928 Amsterdam Games, is one of those spaces. At least it used to be. It became a slum for hundreds of families, but they have now been moved on. The street vendors outside the stadium jealously gossip that the families who lived here were offered a $2,000 payment from the government as compensation for leaving. They left, of course, but they didn't go far. They simply melted into the torn ribbon of blue tents that formed outside the stadium's heavy metal front gates. Now the authorities need the stadium back. Haiti is due to play its first football match since the earthquake, a World Cup qualifier for Brazil 2014 against the US Virgin Islands. This is important for two reasons. Firstly, anything that begins to move Haiti back to a sense of normality is to be cherished. Secondly, the World Cup offers a distraction. World Cup qualification won't put food in a child's mouth or cure a pensioner of cholera, but it fills the time. With little work to go around, time is something that most Haitians have in abundance. But time also fuels rancor. Haiti's new president, Michel Martelly, a former singer, is aggressively promoting the match. He loves football, of course, all Haitians do. But a match against the US Virgin Islands, a team of amateurs who have won only three games in their history, all of them against the British Virgin Islands, is a sure thing. Martelly wants to make good on his campaign slogan, Victoire pour peuple. In Haitian Creole, this means victory for the people. In the absence of any other kind of victory for the people, victory against the US Virgin Islands would have to do. Ironically, time is now against him. The refugees had to be moved, their presence erased by the smell of new paint. A brand new artificial pitch had to be laid too, as the old one had been ruined by the camps. The smell of fresh paint is momentarily thick and intoxicating, but then the wind changes direction, and the smell is replaced by that of burning refuse and human excrement. This year, Haiti is lucky. Hurricane Irene skirts around the Caribbean island of Hispaniola, which Haiti shares with the Dominican Republic to the east. But when it makes landfall in the US, it kills 49 people. The near miss is lucky for Haiti because it's not prepared for a hurricane. It's not really prepared for anything, especially not its first 2014 World Cup qualifier in 24 hours' time. The painters work with urgency,
moving up and down the terraces in jolting movements like an early stop-go animation film. By the main entrance to the stadium, a guard wearing a turquoise Haitian Football Federation t-shirt paces nervously in front of the heavy blue steel door. He is holding a pump-action shotgun tightly in both hands. The guard listens as to the almost constant banging on the front from outside, his fingers hovering above the trigger. When the banging becomes urgent, he pulls the door open, sticks his head out and fires a volley of abuse in Creole. But this time, it's the guests he has been told to expect. The team bus of Les Grenadiers, Haiti's national team, has arrived, bringing the players for training. It is waiting at the gate under heavy armed guard. A curious mob of Haitians have surrounded it. The guards eye them nervously, but they are not in danger. The bus is driven in and the guard quickly heaves the gate closed behind it. For him, everybody is a potential threat. Inside the stadium, a middle-aged man with short dark grey hair and a moustache two shades lighter is walking onto the artificial grass. He is not happy. "It's 46 degrees on the pitch. We just measured it," tisks Edson Tavares, the team's Brazilian coach. "It's 3 in the afternoon. The match is due to be played at the same time the following day." "It's crazy," he says. "FIFA agreed to move the match. CONCACAF said no. What do they know? They work out of New York and know nothing about the heat in the Caribbean." "The change in time is a necessity, but I don't say this to Tavares. Electricity is scarce in the city, too scarce for the expensive but now impotent floodlights that have been installed for the match." The team began to run through their drills in the heat without complaint. Tavares retreats into the shade.
People talk a lot about magic in football, the magic of the cup, the FA Cup being, you know, touted as a sort of magical experience. But what were your ultimate magical moments in football?
I think the American Samoa game. I talked a bit about the first game when they won their first ever game, which was just a beautiful moment. Almost the one that I'll remember more is the third game, because it was a four-team tournament and they'd won their first game, they drew their second game, and suddenly from being the worst team in the world, they then had a shot at qualifying for the next round. And what was amazing was that they went into that game against Samoa, it was a kind of local derby, and seeing how they'd improved when they'd started to believe in themselves and what it meant to try to qualify for a World Cup final, what it meant, what this tournament meant for them as people, but also for the people who were there watching them. And it came down to, effectively, it was 0-0, and it came down to the last couple of minutes. They had a chance and they should have scored and they should have won, and it hit the post, and they eventually ended up losing, conceding in the 90th minute. And the rain came down and there was tears, and it was such an emotional moment. But that was kind of lightning in the bottle, that moment. It was beautiful. And I think that was probably the most magical thing I've ever seen in football, I think. I mean, a lot of the other stuff is, you know, there's been moments of magic, but there's also been a kind of an element of tragedy to it, or sometimes farce. But this was pure. This was absolutely the purest, most beautiful thing I've seen.
There was no sinister undertone.
There was nothing. Even we were playing in the JS Blatter Stadium. You know, it was. I'm not one of these guys that kind of bashes Blatter all the time. I mean, I think FIFA has got its own problems. I think Blatter's been caught in the middle of a lot of it, but. And I share many of his globalist views about how football should be expanded around the world, which is at odds with how many people here see it. But there was nothing cynical about it. It was wonderful, and I wish more people could have felt it. But thankfully, if you go and watch Next Goal Wins or read 31-0, you maybe capture a little bit of it for yourself.
Exactly. Well, probably Blatter, probably not an answer to this next question. But who is the most inspirational person you've met in football?
I think there's a couple. I mean, I when I was in the West Bank for the first time and I met Hani Talgir, the captain of the Palestinian women's national team, and how they were trying desperately to put this team together, and they're trying to overcome so many difficult issues, you know, not just problems amongst, kind of, say, the Muslim community because they didn't they insisting that women should cover when they played, but also in the Christian community in the Palestinian territories because they didn't think it was very becoming of a woman to play football. So they were battling their own communities to try to play. They were battling the occupation because they had very difficulties moving around, playing places. They couldn't go to Jerusalem. They couldn't go to play any games abroad because they couldn't leave. And there'd be threats of arrest and issues of terrorism and poverty and all these kind of things. And at the middle, you had this incredible woman, Honey, who was the captain, who was brilliant as well. I mean,
how old was she? She's like...
She was
early
in
her teens.
She was a bit older than the other girls. She was early 20s.
Okay.
And I met her at Bethlehem University where she was studying. So, I mean, maybe 21 actually when I met her. And, you know, watching that team, I remember their first, one of the first trainings I went to, and it was, they played on this, it was a basketball court, concrete basketball court with, I mean, they just had, you know, jumpers for goalposts, yeah, and it was covered in broken glass, which we had to clean up beforehand. And, you know, despite all the issues, all the political issues, there were times when the I was out there when the Hamas Fatah schism that took place that created this, you know, break between the two groups, between Gaza and the West Bank, took place. And there was fighting and people being killed. And, you know, they got stuck in Jordan. I remember seeing them. They couldn't get back into the country. All of this. Yet this woman was this figurehead and through sheer force of will managed to keep this kind of team together and was a brilliant figurehead for it. And eventually, I remember a few years later, you know, they had built up to the point where they had their first ever home international in the West Bank in the Faisal Al-Husseini Stadium in Ramallah, and right next to the wall. The wall skirts it a few metres away, the separation barrier. And she was, you know, she was there. She was the captain. There was maybe 13,000 fans there watching it, which you wouldn't see for many women's football games in Europe, you know, let alone in the occupied territories. And it was, for me, meeting her, seeing her vision and seeing how it was kind of implemented. And now she's working for FIFA. She's retired now. She's working for FIFA trying to help other girls and women like her to play the game. And I can't think of a... I mean, Bob Bradley's another character, yeah, who many people now know because of the US and also because of Swansea. But I got to see him up close... dealing with the Egyptian national team during the revolution, dealing with players who had witnessed horrific things during the Port Said massacre, where 72 people were killed in this very suspicious incident after a football match. And many of those players had fans dying in their arms, including Mohamed Aboutrika, the famous midfielder who was his main player in the Egyptian national team. And he had to bring all these kind of players, damaged players, and deal with this kind of faltering revolution at the same time. And he did it with so much grace and did it with so much class. The only thing that didn't work out was there was one game against Ghana where they lost 6-1, yeah, and that was the end of they'd won every game, and that was the only thing, that was the only thing that kind of asterisk next to that time. But having seen him and seeing how he operated, I thought this is somebody special. It's a special human. You can argue about coaching methods, sure, and everything like that, but in terms of a human, there are a few.
But he wrote your he wrote your foreword for for When Friday Comes.
Well, there's actually two editions of it. So the first one,
the updated one, I think
the updated
was,
one, yeah, he wrote, so that he read the first one, which I'm not embarrassed of the first one. It's just I was going through a divorce and I was going through quite a hedonistic phase, and when I read it back, a friend of mine mentioned there seems to be quite a lot of drug use mentioned in it, and I looked back and I thought, and not just drug use, but kind of just like you didn't care whether you
just
lived
a bit,
or died,
bit
like
recklessness,
a bit recklessness, so, yeah. And I read it back, and I guess that was kind of where I was going in my life, yeah, and I was kind of in a bit of a reckless phase.
Because you've been described, Grant Wall, the sports illustrator, he called it the Indiana Jones of soccer writing.
I'm living on, yeah, that. I'm going to live on that forever.
Yeah, but do you kind of feel at the same time you're more maybe a Hunter S. Thompson? In those days, perhaps.
I mean, Hunter S. Thompson is again a kind of hero of mine. Not so much for the kind of hedonism, so much as his ability to throw himself completely and 100% in the story, and knowing that if you don't do that, then it's deficient. Mm. You know, you have to feel it, you have to taste it. you know, you have to be scared, you've got to run away from things, and that's when you know that you've I mean, you can never experience fully what it's like to be on the pitch playing in a World Cup qualifier, but I'm going to get as damn close as possible. Yeah. And I think that's him and George Orwell, Homage to Catalonia, especially were two authors that taught you that. You read that and you think you have to be there, you have to be shot at, you know, you have to feel the adrenaline. And I mean, you don't have to be shot at to cover it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's
the sort of the gonzo journalism, the real engagement with the story.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, it's not that you don't, you know, I guess what Orwell does better than Hunter S. Thompson is doesn't put himself front and centre of the story, which with every book I've done less and less. Grant, I've met him a couple of times, and he said this thing about Indiana Jones. So I'm gonna have that plastered on every single book forever. But
it's a great tagline.
It's a great tagline. So I'm gonna have it. And but it's more. I think it's just. I mean, I can't. For me, it's simple. You know, if you're interested in the world and a story, then you have to get to it. Mm. And strangely, I mean, journalism is in flux, changing. You know, there aren't foreign correspondents like there were. Everything's freelance. But to me, it seems that the only thing that does have currency and does have value is your own experience of something. I mean, everybody can write blogs. Everybody can, do a kind of think piece on the latest Liverpool transfer. Yeah. I mean, there's millions of people who can sit there anywhere in the world and do that. But how many people are there
in the field
yeah. And it's not, I mean, this is one thing for younger journalists that I would recommend. I mean, I was talking to Nick Ames about this, who writes for The Guardian, who does, I mean, we do very similar work and often our paths cross. And we were in my next book after this one is going to be about the Kosovo national team. Mm. And I've been following them around during their first kind of campaign, and we're at the first game in Finland, and it was just me and him. You know, there weren't any other Western journalists there, and you just think, you know, this is where people should be. This is, I mean, thankfully not, because I guess there's less competition for us. Yeah. But I mean, as a young journalist, I'd recommend, you know, get out there, go to these places. It's really cheap to travel, much cheaper than when I started out. I mean, you can read, I mean, when you read about Simon Cooper, he used his entire advance for Football Against the Enemy and actually travelled around, he told me, with a what's it called, a typewriter,
yeah,
not a laptop. So this is how long
that,
ago
that is
it?
The Hunter S. Thompson look,
that really is, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, even maybe, I mean, that'd be a bit too retro, and it's too heavy to take one of those around. And also my fingers, my hands are too big for that kind of stuff, so typing on a big thing like that. But it's you have to be out there, you've got to sense it. And so covering matches in a way would be the death of me, I think. Go, like,
not your thing.
Living in England, I love watching Premier League football,
but from afar.
But on television, in a bar on my own somewhere else.
Yeah.
Because if I had to go and cover games, I mean, I think I would probably kill myself. People write fantastic match reports, and that's great. It's just it's a dwindling market, you know. Everybody has access to everything and have their own opinions very quick. And to me, this is the only thing I think that has any longevity, I think, you know.
Talking of other writers, finally, just to wrap things up, we've got a chance for you to suggest three books that we have to read, three other football books.
One of my favourite football books of all time is Gary Imlach, My Father and Other Working Class Heroes. I thought that was, for me, that reading that, this was before I was a football journalist, and it was so heartfelt and so smart. And first-person stuff doesn't usually, it sometimes can leave you very cold. And I knew Gary Imlach. I used to love American football back in the day. So he was, you know, I remember his name from when he was doing the Channel 4 American football stuff. I was a big Houston Oilers fan, I remember, at the time, because we'd lost the Premier League, we'd lost the football then, and we didn't have Sky. So I remember the first thing, I think they had Kabaddi on Channel 4, then Italian football, then American football, and I knew Gary Imlach from that. And so I would thoroughly recommend that. It would be, the second one would almost certainly have to be Football Against the Enemy by Simon Cooper. I think that's the granddad of all the you know, this kind of subgenre that I think I'd hopefully consider myself part of, which is foreign football writing that tries to tell a little bit more about than just the football.
That was his first book, wasn't it?
That's his first book, and it's still holds up when you read it. It's
what's it about? Just quickly,
he basically travels. I mean, there's no kind of narrative, like there's no connecting thread in a way. It's just going to different places around the world and trying to explain how football, football and politics is very reflective. You can understand about the world through football, and you forget kind of back then how what a huge thing that was, because a lot of people were writing about football, either it was player biographies, but in a very, like, you're kind of like an idiot. And he brought kind of political sensibility to it, and a social kind of lens that I thought was, really that changed the way I wanted to do things.
Suddenly you thought, oh, here's my avenues go down. Well,
funnily enough, when I first had the idea for When Friday Comes, I was kind of, the first book I read that kind of made me think I could do this was a book called Baghdad Without a Map, which is about an American, young American foreign correspondent in the Middle East and his kind of adventures. But then I read that and it was kind of, oh, balls, somebody's done it. And then I read it and I was like, yeah, this is it. This is what I've got to do. And then, you know, I think it won't be any surprise, The Ball Is Round by David Goldblatt. I mean, The Game of Our Lives won the William Hill last year. It's another great book. Mm. I'll read everything he'd write, even if it was kind of menu.
So The Ball Is Round is a sort of general history of football,
That doesn't even do it justice.
No.
I mean, it's like a 1,000-word tour de force of political, social and football analysis of every corner of the world. It's just, it was magnificent, you know.
What was your favourite part of it?
We went to Lebanon. So I was very much interested in the Middle Eastern sections of it at first, but it was the broad scope of it. That was it. What I was most excited about by it was just how vast it was. I mean, you could choose 10 places like Simon Cooper did, and you know, but this blew the doors off. This was like, anything is possible. You know, you can write anything. You know, it was like. You know, you're watching kind of an analog television and suddenly you've got the internet. You know, it was just, and it just expanded my mind and expanded what my ambition of what is possible to write. And I think rather than picking out a specific chapter, I think that for me was what it did. It was an expansion of my horizon.
All made sense.
And it all made sense. And you think that somebody's work can have that effect on you. And it wouldn't just be me. There'd be millions of people out there, you know. And I think he's another... He's won the William Hill. I think he doesn't get enough credit here. I think. I mean, he's hugely well known and respected in the US. And you know, I'd like to see him more. When you see kind of pundits and commentators and kind of ex professionals, and it seems a lot of it's a very simplistic.
You'd like to see more renowned writers of that stature come on.
Absolutely. You know, I think he'd definitely shake it up. He's just kind of this garrulous character with big dreadlocks, and you know, I'd love to see him next to Jamie Redknapp. I think it'd be a marriage made in heaven.
Oh, sounds fantastic. Yeah, well, thank you very much for coming in today.
You're welcome.
All the best for the Billionaires Club. I hope to see it in May. I'll pre-order it anyway.
Thank you very much.
So,
as long as I don't get assassinated before.
No, let's hope not. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you very much, James Montague, for coming in for an episode of One on One. We'll be back every 2 weeks interviewing people about their love of the game. So stay tuned, keep posted, and we'll catch you very soon.